What's going on, y'all? It's Cat Magnus, the propagandist. It is Thursday. Was it March 18th? It's Thursday, October 15th, and this is the Awakened Demagogue podcast. I just out of nowhere got a headache. It's crazy. All right, so I want to chat with you guys about today is the importance of keeping up with space policy, space technology, as well as the emergence of artificial intelligence and investment in various technologies, especially in the cyber realm. We all know cybersecurity is important based on election interference, right? I have far too many connections on LinkedIn that work with or for the DOD, the U.S. Department of Defense. I have a couple of people in state on my LinkedIn, but a ton of those people are for the DOD. They actually kind of exhaust me sometimes. And you know, their buzzwords are all about innovation, which is just a key buzzword just in tech, and AI and in cyberspace, period. And then, you know, some of them are like futurists and they're all trying to use all these cute little terms. But, you know, as we can see, based upon the results of us lacking in the cyber area, they're kind of having too much fun with the buzzwords and the hashtags and not actually making headway, which is a critique that even comes from them. So this is not me talking out of my ass. It's actually a real problem. But in any case, what really got me back into asking questions about space and space tech and where we are in that exploration is just binge watching Ancient Aliens and my favorite Stargate series. And the one thing I liked about the Stargate series and its spinoffs was that it was the most realistic of all the sci-fi shows, because as we see with the Space Force, the military will most likely be the body that actually deals with outer space exploration. We do have the private sector. We have Richard Branson, I think that's his name. Something like that. The guy that does Virgin. We have Virgin Galactic that's trying to work on a commercial space flight or space orbit. Like lower Earth orbit. I guess space tourism, that's going to be a new thing. We got Jeff Bezos, who also wants to figure out how to colonize not just Mars, but other planets, because he feels that the future of humanity is in space. And if you want to continue with unlimited growth, the only place we have to go is into outer space. I think he wants to do... Blue Origin is actually working with SpaceX and the DOD, I believe, or at least NASA, on the Artemis program and that... whole initiative towards outer space exploration. You know, everyone knows Elon Musk and SpaceX, he wants to colonize Mars. So, you know, we have some of these private sector moments, but since the first space race, it's basically been a public sector thing, kind of split half and half between the military and the civilians, like NASA, civilian bodies like NASA, and then of course like the DOD, Air Force, and all of that. But what, you know, what's really, and that's why it's so, Stargate is so realistic, because it actually illustrates within its storyline, one, the fact that the military is going to have a heavy, if not desirably sole role in space exploration. Of course, the reality that as they explore space, they're going to look for resources that can be used for weapons or to enhance technology or whatever. The private sector is going to want to mine and use things for their own private sector, whatever the heck, whether they're developing a new technology or just something novelty to sell to people who have money to waste. So you got Blue Origin, I think it was Jeff Bezos, Amazon, Blue Origins, they want to mine asteroids, or maybe that was just, or it was the Obama administration. You know, after a while, you read through all this stuff, and everybody just wants their hands on what's in outer space, and they all kind of overlaps, but someone wanted to mine asteroids, and like somebody watched Armageddon way too many damn times, to basically discover new naturally occurring rare materials that could be useful here back on Earth, or to enhance our own technology to further explore space, which I think would be the most beneficial direction to go with that kind of research or discovery. So the reality is that it may seem a little out of this world or too unrealistic or sci-fi-esque for us, you know, mere mortals here on the ground to wrap our minds around, to think about, you know, space exploration and space policy. But the Planetary Society, founded by Bill Nye and a few other guys, actually focuses on space policy. They actually lobby for space policy. One of their achievements is, I have it right here, they successfully, that's not the right page, but they successfully, let me just get to space policy and advocacy, and you can go to planetary.org and actually look at all of the information that they have. Go to space policy and advocacy. This is another thing. I'm actually going to write an article and see where I get it published, and if it doesn't go anywhere, it goes on my blog. Demystifying the art of lobbying. Lobbying is not reserved for the rich and the powerful and the elite. Any person, when you start a petition, when you sign a petition, when you vote, when you vote for a particular legislation one way or the other, when you write your congressman or your state representatives, when you campaign for whoever you want to win, when you take time to fill out a form to actually set up a meeting with a legislator, all of that is lobbying. Anybody can do it. The thing about it is, if you do it for money, if you earn $5,000 or more, you have to, by law, become a registered lobbyist. But at the end of the day, lobbying is not some esoteric thing. If you understand the legislative process, which we were all taught in elementary school and high school, or, you know, throughout, some of us paid attention, some of us didn't. You paid attention to that, and you keep up with the policies that you care about, and then you decide to go meet with your representatives and talk to them about how you feel and what policies you think are best. That is lobbying. Period. Lobbying is not, you know, just for former congressmen and women or former politicians or retired politicians or people with money or corporations or people like me who have consultancies and things. Anybody can do it, right? Like, we just really need to get that clear. And any policy-driven nonprofit, whether it's the Planetary Society or the Human Rights Campaign or something like that, the ACLU, whatever it is, they all have materials for the average Joe to go meet with their congressmen or state representatives or whatever to pitch and advocate for policies that matter to the people. Anybody can do it. All it costs you is some time to study and get the resources together and the transportation to get to the meeting. Anybody can do it, right? So, like, let's stop acting like lobbying is some big thing that's only for big law or PR firms. It's really not that. It's not that. It's actually very basic. The thing is, big corporations and people just with money are able to do the quid pro quo style of lobbying, which is tit for tat, give one thing in exchange for the other, you know, pass this policy that benefits my company or my tax bracket, and I will give you, typically what they give is significant campaign donations to make sure that these people can stay in office. So, and the reality is, people, you know, and they're shiny, a little, you know, they're shiny objects. They like to have something that's going to make them personally feel like they're being propped up or pushed in the right direction that they want to go, which is mostly staying in power and having the perks that come along with that. You know, people want to be famous, people want to do all this stuff, and, you know, politics gives you a different kind of fame, but it gives you power too, and people like having that. So if you're an average person, if you have something to offer, maybe you're a six-figure earner or a seven-figure earner, low-key, and you can promise them, you and 10 of your friends will donate $2,500 to their campaign if they lean towards this policy. That's something that they'll think about. If you know, that period, you know what I mean? Because that's a significant amount of money. that's a significant amount of campaign funding, right? Or you can say, you know, me, I have a few well-off friends. Even if you're not, like, if you're like me and you're just kind of restarting your life or changing your career or whatever it is, but you have access to people who have lots of money by one way or another, and you can say, hey, I can get 10 of my millionaire friends to give you $10,000 if you support this policy that we are all in favor of, then that's a bargaining chip that you can use to promote or advocate for whatever policy that you are passionate about. For me, space and tech, and especially in light of international relations and what will eventually become interplanetary relations, and if we continue to find, if we actually discover and find life in other, you know, galaxies, you know, intergalactic relations, you know what I mean? So that matters to me. That's something that I would like to really focus on. But, you know, back to the Planetary Society and what they have achieved. One of their achievements was establishing the first Planetary Science Caucus in the United States Congress. Now, that is actually very important, not just in further understanding our planet, but understanding other planets throughout, you know, not just the solar system, not just the planets that we're already familiar with, but, you know, throughout the cosmos and other galaxies. And, you know, the research, the SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, that, you know, that institute, the work that they do, and if they discover extraterrestrial intelligence or life, and then, you know, make some kind of contact, then what does that mean for us? And how do we govern ourselves? And do we, you know, hoard the information with ourselves? Do we hoard, you know, hold on to those connections? Or do we tell Russia and China and other, the EU and all the other bigwigs around the world? And how do we share that information? How does that impact how we see ourselves in the universe, as how we see ourselves compared to one another here just on Earth, and how we interact? That is very important. It all trickles down into how we live our daily lives, because it changes, it shifts entire paradigms, right? It challenges every religious or cultural belief that leans toward saying that there is no life out there, right? And then it also, the mainstream understanding of cultural beliefs and religions such as Hinduism and whatnot, that actually believe, and it's not just Hinduism, it's actually every indigenous tribal belief, that there are connections to extraterrestrial, intraterrestrial, or interdimensional beings, right? So to have that validated in a concrete way, to where even the deniers, or, you know, who people think, people who think science fiction is pure fiction, they now have to come into accepting a new reality. You know what I mean? It just shifts everything. It changes everything. It changes how we see ourselves. It changes how we are going to live daily life. It, you know, sets the stage for the official disclosure that people in the UFO community are just really waiting on, and that there are actual paid and professional lobbyists who focus on just disclosure. You know, so it's not just some weird thing that you see on Ancient Aliens where it's just like, huh, this is interesting, but we don't really know. No, it actually becomes something concrete. And that's why it's really important, because it shifts everybody's worldview. Because, you know, if you're a geocentrist and then you realize that the universe really doesn't revolve around Earth, because there's so many other beings and everything else in the universe that doesn't even give a shit about us, and you realize it really doesn't revolve around us, literally, physically, metaphorically, figuratively, at all. What does that mean? You know what I mean? It just changes everything. So it's very important that we keep space and cyber at the forefront of our minds, because it's not only an illustration or a way to better understand the past and the, you know, the things that are discovered by archaeologists and anthropologists, and understanding, you know, what we decipher and decode in various antiquities, but it's also about the future of humanity. Like I said, we got Elon Musk hell-bent on colonizing Mars. We got Jeff Bezos, who wants to figure out how to just create technology that can sustain human life anywhere in the universe, because for him, unlimited growth means going out into space. We are already on track towards being a space-faring species, not just, you know, country by country, but a space-faring species. I mean, for all intents and purposes and considering, you know, the space race of the 1950s and 60s and all of that, and during the Cold War, we've begun our journey as a spacefaring species, but, you know, right now we just have spacefaring nations here and there. We still do not have the actual cohesive, like, Stargate Atlantis, you know, expedition where you get the top talent from every country and put them on the same expedition. No, we are still very fragmented where, you know, India's doing their thing, China's doing their thing, Russia's doing their thing, the United States is doing our thing, and in some ways, we cooperate because, you know, NASA got defunded, so we have to use Russian launching pads or something like that. Or something, you know, we just now have, you know, reignited our ability to launch spacecraft. But that's by partnering, public-private partnerships, because we're working with SpaceX to do that, so now we're not relying on Russian launch pads and all that as much. But anyway, you know, we have some minor areas where we kind of work together multilaterally. You know, some nations work together on some projects. In the Artemis initiative, we have the Artemis Accords, which basically allows, you know, that's put forth by the Trump administration and his drive to go to back to the moon and put the first woman on the moon and do some other more accessible space-related activities. Of course, we have the Space Force that, you know, kind of militarizes space, which is technically against the... It's a treaty, Outer Space Treaty, I believe, of 1966, which basically says that everything in space belongs to humanity, and there should be no one nation trying to stake a claim to the moon or to Mars or, you know, one resource or whatever. If, you know, you find something on Mars, you can't patent it and say it only belongs to you at all. It belongs to everyone. However, there's no way to really enforce compliance with that, so it's just kind of this figurative feel-good thing that exists that nobody really pays attention to, like most of international law, let's be honest. And the Artemis Accords actually kind of build off of that Outer Space Treaty and extend it, but the thing is, it's really just about the Artemis program and what the Trump administration is trying to do, and it kind of just outsources a little bit, right? Like, you gotta think about who Trump is. He's this billionaire businessman, no matter, you know, how many times he failed or whatever. Like, he still is who he is, and he has his track record, you know, of whatever, and he has what he has, and he didn't pay whatever taxes he didn't pay. So obviously, traversing space, exploring space, and finding new technology, finding new resources, that is a tall order for any one corporation or one world, you know, in national government, right? So you say, we are on this mission to do this, go to the moon and do these things, and eventually get to Mars and do those things. And any nation that wants to help us out and work as a team is welcome. But if you join us, we have to follow the rules that were outlined in the Outer Space Treaty of 1965. Excuse me. So, that's all well and good. And that just basically says nobody can claim any resource or, you know, planet for its own. It all belongs to humanity. There's a requirement to share technology, share information, share discoveries, share findings. It's a requirement of transparency. So, you know, it actually, it's beneficial to us because we are the managing partner, as, you know, some at the Council of Foreign Relations have put it. We're the managing partner, basically, of the current international space program, right? As far as multiple nations working together to develop technology. You know, because after the whole Sputnik thing, JFK said, look, we're about to just get on this, you know, we're about to develop our space programs, and we are going to shoot for the moon, we're going to land on the moon, and we're going to outdo those guys, and we got on our science and technology and innovation, and we now are the leaders in the space domain, right? And we're trying to maintain that. We laid out the international order as we know it. Now we, you know, run the space domain to a point. In the Artemis Accords, if anybody wants to join in on what we're trying to do, you got to follow the rules. You got to share all your discoveries. You got to be transparent. And everything doesn't belong to you or us. We are all working towards this one goal. But it does not put limitations on any private institution that want to explore. It doesn't say that another country can't take its, you know, launch its own lunar missions to achieve whatever goals that nation wants to. It's just, if you want to work with us on this particular program, then these are the rules that you actually have to follow. And all of this is going on right here, right now, in this moment. But nobody's really talking about it because everyone is just so hell-bent on getting rid of Trump. But the thing is, focusing on space and cyber, which is not something that even Trump really, you know, toots his own horn about, but it's actually, one, a good play, two, very necessary, and three, I mean, from what I've read over the past couple of days, none of it is unreasonable. I would say that, you know, when we talk about the broken clock being right twice a day, this is one of the times where he's actually, you know, it's 12 o'clock. And I really respect that, because if we don't pay attention to space, if we don't pay attention to cyber, security or just technological development as a whole, especially artificial intelligence, the future will be made without us. And if we successfully create a new civilization or fragment of civilization on Mars or something, you know, in the near but more than likely distant future, if we really make that solid progress there and nobody's paying attention, then it will just be this dystopian world where only the rich and the powerful and the elite who actually pay attention to these things will benefit from it. Because if we're all worried about racism and these archaic, mundane and profane yet very real issues, those who are actually taking humanity into a new paradigm are going to be the only ones enjoying the new paradigm and maybe even potential paradise. You know what I mean? If we actually successfully create like mini colonies on Mars to work on long-term terraforming, you know, those people no longer become, they're no longer Earthlings. They become the first generation Martians, especially if they procreate. You know what I mean? What the hell does that mean for humanity? First of all, that is huge. You know, and even if we just get, you know, Virgin Galactic off the ground and we have space tourism where people can go take a 1 to 2 hour ride to float in space and feel what it's like to be weightless and all of that, I mean, that's still going to be out of touch for the average Joe until so many companies are doing it and then our, you know, our lower Earth orbit and all of that is just too crowded to be accessible. You know, so how do we position ourselves and recalibrate our consciousness, recalibrate our interests towards space and cyber, because they actually overlap. And in the next segment, because this one's starting to run long, in the next segment I'm going to get into just focus a little bit more on the IR part, the militarization of space, multilateral cooperation, and, you know, the real why behind Trump's focus on space and cyber. Like, you know, everyone clowned him for launching the Space Force, but China and Russia already have their own forms of a Space Force or Aerospace Force focused solely on the convergence between cyber tech and space. Because you can't explore, even understand space without advanced technologies, right? And even on Ancient Aliens, they had, you know, technological professionals and AI professionals that were looking at 3D technology being used and, you know, infused into space probes to where space probes become self-replicating. And, you know, since space travel actually can degenerate the human body, until we can master a way for the human body to withstand space travel, it's better to have artificial intelligence exploring the universe, or at least, you know, the solar system or whatever, to give us feedback and give us data. And then if they, you know, with 3D printing technology, if they can be self-replicating, then we cover more quote-unquote ground or cover more space. That is very important, especially where we have great power competition and a second wave space race. Because who's going to create the self-replicating technology first? Who's going to get to what, you know, place in the solar system or the galaxy first? Who's going to make the first discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence and disclose it to the public? Who is going, you know, what country is going to reveal that it has had diplomatic relations with extraterrestrial races or intraterrestrial races or interdimensional beings? Who's going to disclose that first? What technological or space technological advantages have to be in place for that disclosure to happen? And we have to stop thinking that this is too far away or this is too outlandish and understand that this is real. This is right here, right now, in this moment, happening right under our noses. It's being published about. It's being written about. Not enough, because people are having too much fun with the petty worldly shit. But it's happening right here, right now, in this moment, and it has been happening. And yes, it died down after the original moon landing that some people still believe is a hoax. But right now, you know, I believe it was 2012 when London was hosting the World Global Olympics, and they had this magnificent opening ceremony. And then here comes Obama taking all the clout by announcing that we landed the first probe on Mars. Right? And that's us competing against our own damn ally for attention. Right? So, like, let's just really think about what this means as far as the great power competition that's going on right now between the US, Russia, and China. Because Russia might not do very well making anything happen on Earth, but it was their first satellite, the Sputnik, that was successfully launched that got US presidents shook and say, oh, shit, Russia just did something we didn't. We need to get on the ball. We need to invest in science and technology and engineering, and we need to get in outer space, and we need to surpass them, because if they eclipse us in space, we just might be done here on Earth. So in the next segment, I'm going to get a little bit more into that. All right, y'all, round two. So in the last segment, I gave a little general overview of why I think it's important to pay attention to the second round space race and its convergence with cyber technology and artificial intelligence. Right now, I want to focus a little bit more on the international relations, the IR, and great power competition piece around that, according to an article in Foreign Affairs. Just kind of picking it out of the middle. Read a little excerpt. Militaries across the world have taken notice, but none more so than in China and Russia. Beijing's 2015 military strategy referred to outer space as part of the new commanding heights in strategic competition, end quote. And Chinese leaders have established a strategic support force designed to bring its military, space, and cyber missions under one umbrella. Moscow has similarly created an integrated aerospace force tasked with missions including detecting and, quote-unquote, meeting threats from space. Both countries are developing and deploying anti-satellite weapons to undermine U.S. military effectiveness in the event of a conflict. China has an operational ground-based hit-to-kill anti-satellite missile intended to target satellites in low orbit, and its military has begun training with anti-satellite missiles. Russia, meanwhile, is likely developing a similar system and has also claimed to be developing air-launched missiles to target U.S. satellites, and both countries are developing laser technologies to damage satellite sensors, with Russia recently fielding a ground-based laser weapon, likely for an anti-satellite mission. Both are also building electronic warfare capabilities to block signals from U.S. communications and navigation satellites. China and Russia also appear to be developing space-based anti-satellite capabilities. capabilities. According to the U.S. Department of Defense, China is working toward having the ability to launch China is working toward having the ability to launch anti-satellite strikes from other satellites. And at the UN Conference on Disarmament in Geneva in 2018, the U.S. State Department expressed concerns about the abnormal behavior of a Russian military satellite. Moscow claims it is intended to support satellite inspection missions, but the State Department argues that the satellite's behavior is inconsistent with this claim. So, and then, you know, we also have China may also be working toward targeting satellites in higher altitude orbits. In May 2013, Beijing launched an object with a peak altitude above 30,000 kilometers, which a Pentagon report argues could have been a test aimed at achieving high orbit anti-satellite capability. So there is a real threat of sorts and a real potential for us to have actual space wars or star wars with not just, you know, the imaginative extraterrestrial race, whether it's a Stargate or a Star Wars or a Star Trek, but just with each other, you know, nation to nation, great power competition. I don't know why I'm just getting that backwards today, but, you know, the title of this article that I just read an excerpt from is Why Creating a Space Force Changes Nothing. Now, if one was to presume that Trump's creation of the Space Force was supposed to just, you know, shift, you know, make everybody shake in their boots and stop what they're doing because the U.S. is, you know, about to militarize space, or as the media probably would have put it, nobody but Trump is trying to make a Space Force, which is actually untrue. China and Russia have had their own forms of a Space Force, as we can see, probably for a few years. And that's a real problem. That's a real threat. And you have to understand, if you appreciate and love and rely on your Google Maps, your GPS, your Google Street Views, and that's just the civilian, you know, public commercial tools that we actually have access to on a daily basis. If you appreciate those, if you rely on those, if you rely on international communications from your cell phones, you want your satellite, you want our satellites to keep working. You don't want them to be interfered with by Russia and China. And these are things that are very likely to happen. You know, it's not just some magical EMP from, you know, just in the sky. Like, they can really target our satellite to satellite, whether it's from the ground or satellite to satellite. Interference or disruption can happen at any given point in time. You gotta understand, Russia and China, we may cooperate here and there under, you know, the liberal institutions of the UN, you know, and then Putin, you know, wants to flex, so he talks about international law that we all know he himself does not actually care about, but he likes to flex with it when he wants to shake his finger at the United States. You know, we have to understand that these people are not our friends. Right? Even if they're just, you know, called competitors, because we don't want to call them adversaries or enemies, because then they might be offended and then try to take out one of our satellites. You know, at the end of the day, they're not our friends. Right? We may cooperate on certain things because it's advantageous for, you know, either nations or both nations' interests or goals that they're seeking to achieve. But at the end of the day, they're not our friends. Right? And the Space Force is not some anomaly made up in the mind of, you know, Donald Trump because he wants to feel special. There's a real threat or potential threat from Russia and China in space. Yes, we need to meet that, period. And it's interesting because an article published by the Council of Foreign Relations, and the magazine Foreign Affairs is actually published by the Council on Foreign Relations. In this article, there's a statement that says, difficult UN negotiations on both cyberspace norms and space issues, including the militarization of space, suggest that multilateral cooperation on space systems cybersecurity is unlikely to be productive. So basically, it's saying current negotiations on cyberspace norms and space issues, because everyone, you know, wants to have their hand in the pot and be able to say they made this discovery, they did this first, and, you know, they found this resource, how are they going to make it beneficial for them so they can not only just, you know, further rule over their own people, but maybe say that they have this disadvantage to potentially rule the world. You know, hello China. As we can see, the Cosmic kind of thwarted that aim. But anyway, you know, all these negotiations on intended to thwart, or I would say diffuse the appetite, reduce the appetite for self-serving space exploration or cyberspace norms. Getting people on board to, you know, without their appetite at the fore, without the focus on their benefit, it's kind of hard, right? And just learning from these difficult negotiations, as we have seen, it's not really going to be productive if they actually find some kind of multilateral cooperation initiative. It's not likely to be productive anyway. I would revise that statement to say it's just unlikely, you know, the multilateral cooperation on space system cybersecurity is unlikely, period. Like, just end the statement. Like, let's be real. There's literally an infinite number of advantages that any one nation can cultivate for itself here on Earth and in space with its own space program and, you know, a successful discovery of, you know, validating that Europa or another one of Jupiter's moons is habitable, something like that. There's just too much to be gained to say, yeah, we're all going to sit in around in a circle and say kumbaya and do it all for the benefit of humanity. That's the realist perspective. At the end of the day, if you can create the most powerful spacecraft, you have the ultimate advantage, right? And, you know, let's say these alliances with extraterrestrial, interdimensional, intraterrestrial beings are real, and each country has, you know, its own diplomatic relations with one, two, or more races. And, you know, there within that, there's potential for competition here on Earth as we go to explore the heavens, right? There's just too much. There's too much opportunity for there to be the assumption that cooperation, multilateral cooperation, is realistic. It's not realistic, and it's not likely. Like, fuck unlikely to be productive. It's just unlikely. Multilateral cooperation on space system cybersecurity is unlikely, period. It just is. Look at where we are right now. You know, a test run with election interference around the world. It's not just about, you know, you don't even have to hack our voting systems. You know, they hacked our consciousness. One of the hashtags and the DOD community in, I don't know if I really want to say foreign policy community, but definitely in the DOD community, one of their hashtags and fun LinkedIn buzzwords is cognitive warfare, because they just now realized, all late to the party, that, oh my God, they hacked human consciousness and how we think and process information. They didn't have to hack our systems. They didn't have to send out an EMP. They didn't have to take out one of our satellites. All they did was, you know, run a successful disinformation propaganda campaign, because that's the only thing Russia is good at, propaganda. And boom, they got a hack. But at the end of the day, what kind of a hack did they really get? I mean, you know, Trump can still be a competitor or an adversary or an enemy for China and Russia. And everyone's, you know, kind of sick of his shit at this point. You know, even the people that tried to help him get where he is. Everyone's kind of sick of his shit right now. But, you know, at the end of the day, from a worldview perspective of authoritarianism versus democracy, Trump is an authoritarian personality, as we have seen. And he would like to be able to have kind of a lockstep grip on the American consciousness the way the Chinese Communist Party or Putin himself. I don't know if he even has a party. He's just, you know, he's trying to bring back the days of the czars in his own right, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, you got North Korea, Kim Jong-un, his own thing. And Trump just kind of, whether he actually is friends with those people, he still wants to be like them. He wants to have that iron grip on American consciousness, right? Because he's an authoritarian personality. And ultimately, that is in alignment with how Xi Jinping, Vladimir Putin, Kim Jong-un, how it's an alignment on how they view the world and how it should be governed, in the sense that there should be one power, one party, one person who dictates and has control over its subjects, right? So that is an advantageous alignment based on a worldview that hopefully they can eradicate democracy and at best return to a day of a legitimate Game of Thrones, and they can go back to the, you know, the consciousness that created World War I, World War II, launch a World War III, and hopefully the East will win, and then we'll all be under the whims of, you know, Russia and or China. You know, I'm sure that's, you know, ultimately the goal for those guys over there on that side of the planet. But then there's that eye of providence over America, right? And, you know, when I'm looking at these clips from the Amy Coney Barrett hearings, I have to wonder, because the thing about judges is that, you know, you got a prime example. All of that drama about Brett Kavanaugh, and then he is on the Supreme Court and then ruled against a court ruling that would have favored Trump. He ruled against Trump's position, right? So at the end of the day, and that's the thing about real conservatives. They are about the Constitution. We are about the Constitution. We are about our rights. We are about preserving those rights. We are about preserving the integrity of America. We are about maintaining our power and position, and understanding that there must be a divine hand that has, you know, placed us where we are. And, you know, the hand of God is really kind of being waved over America, because although it's a shit fest, we haven't completely imploded. You know, we didn't do a USSR. We're still here. We're just a little off our rockers right now. And I just really feel like Amy Coney Barrett is going to be good, because she, you know, will likely, at the end of the day, you can play politics all you want with these hearings, but when they get on, as justices, conservatives, you know, in alignment with their moral compass, you know, they are more likely to be objective, right? Like, because the judiciary, constitutionally, is supposed to be an independent body. It's not partisan. It's not about politics. It's about the Constitution and upholding the Constitution and people's constitutional rights to life, liberty, property, their freedoms, and, you know, ruling on cases in alignment with that. And I think that Amy Coney Barrett has the potential to do that. And you can see that in all of her answers, because if it's not something directly related to a Supreme Court case that she may or may not feel is appropriate to give her opinion on in that forum, she's not really going to entertain anything that's been thrown at her. And that's very important. That's very important to pay attention to, because, and I think people are so caught up in the polarization of politics that they kind of forget that judges aren't supposed to speak on political topics. They're not supposed to be politicized. They are judges, and they go by the rule of law, and they employ it, and they, you know, in the Supreme Court, they go by what is or is not constitutional, period. That's it. Like, it's not about anybody's political agenda. It's just, does this follow the Constitution? And she is an originalist, which means that she interprets the law or would rule according to the Constitution in its original wording, in its original intention. And that's really just it. I think she actually ultimately will be really good. Some people may not like her or what she comes up with or what she's done in the past, but I think she actually has the capacity to do what she seems like a person that's going to get in there and do her job and do it well, period. It doesn't matter what party or who chose her. I just really feel a really strong, she's just there. She's just going to do her job, and she really doesn't give a shit. And, you know, she's got 7 kids, and guess what? She doesn't give a shit how you feel. You know, she's tired right now, okay? It's just do this, and let's get this in order, and let's get this right. And that's something that is respectable about Trump's choices is that, you know, like, you know, he chose Kavanaugh, everyone, the Dems lost their shit about it, and Kavanaugh, you know, ruled against something that Trump would have wanted. Well, I mean, that's what he put him there to do, to interpret, you know, a case according to the Constitution, and if it's in alignment with the Constitution, then you go for it. You know, you decide for whatever side is, you know, in alignment with the Constitution, and you rule in that way, period. The fucking end. Right? So, you know, and it just makes me think about, you know, if there is this eye of providence or hand of God or, you know, higher interdimensional or extraterrestrial beings or whatever it is, or whatever, whoever they are, that, you know, if there really is that otherworldly influence or presence in protecting the integrity of what not just America was meant to become, but where it's also meant to go. I mean, if the left could have it their way, it's easy to see how that would be dismantled based on what we all fight for, the equality to live our lives, to, you know, to exercise a 14th Amendment to life, liberty, and property, amongst other things, due process, and so on and so forth. To maintain the integrity of those ideals, you need people who really believe in them. And I, you know, the left is too far gone, and it's, well, we can all share total and complete power amongst our party and force socialism in there and keep the people below us because we in our 500,000 degrees think we are better than all of the other peasants who may or may not even have a measly bachelor's degree. It's definitely not a relevant one. You know what I mean? These intellectual elites who think they themselves are God or gods with a little g. You know what I mean? Like, there's still a higher power or just more advanced being that exist within the universe, whether we have seen or directly interacted with them or not, right? And the left would completely destroy that for the limitations of human cognition, right? Or the potential for what America was supposed to be, for the power of and illusion of ego aggrandizement and just, you know, an ego illusion, self, you know, just the selfishness of it, right? So to have someone like Trump, he's not, you know, he's definitely a major setback, but he may be the ultimate setup for the United States going forward. And the thing is, we're so caught up on the buzzwords and the racism and, like I said, all of these very real and legitimate problems that still need resolving and reconciliation, but we're so caught up in them that we don't see the big picture, because we do need the focus on space. We do need the focus on cyber. And, you know, if you really want to talk about cyberspace, I mean, that's not just the internet. I mean, there's space is literally in the word, you know, cyberspace and space issues, right? Like the space, like it's very important because that is the future. It's also our past, you know, it's just in human consciousness and civilization and spiritual understanding and philosophy and development in all of those realms. These are very pivotal keys that need to be focused on, not just by legislators and lawmakers, not just by the military and, you know, securing our assets against Russia and China, who ultimately just want to take us down and make a world, new world order in their image, especially with AI. And China is really on with the freaking AI. I was actually watching a documentary on Frontline, by Frontline, called The Age of AI, and it just really explored how China is on the cutting edge of artificial intelligence, and with its Belt and Road initiative, and it seek in, you know, investing in infrastructure around the world and using, you know, it's like a package deal that they sell to these developing countries. They'll go build a bridge or some new police force apparatus or something, and then they'll just give them, like, you know, cameras, low-level AI surveillance technology, while they have advanced Black Mirror AI surveillance technology. You know what I mean? And ultimately create a global surveillance state. I mean, even the United States, you know, do you really think either party would pass up the opportunity to use China-style artificial intelligence and social points to decide who's a good citizen, who's worthy, who's not, especially the fucking left? You know what I mean? Like, fuck the right. The left would love to find a way to implement that. You know what I mean? And it's just like, you know, one thing that they pointed out in the Frontline documentary is that advanced technology may actually be more beneficial to authoritarian nations and states than it would be to democratic nation states. Right? Especially here in America. We already are at each other's throats trying to figure out what lines need to be drawn as far as privacy and cybersecurity and surveillance. And we already think that it's just going to lead to taking away our freedoms. And many people, especially in China and the Uyghurs, who are like super duper, you know, what am I going to say? They are at the extreme, I guess you could say, of being a surveillance state, within a surveillance state, like a surveillance colony of some sort, you know. And the intent, or at least the spin for it, is, well, they have to monitor these people closely and have facial recognition and all of these things so they can weed out who is a terrorist, right? The right would love to use that spin for that kind of technology. I could tell you that right now because they're a bunch of war hawks. But you know, we also are about peace through strength as well. That's why we believe in investing in our military. I don't, trust me, we don't put the money exactly where it should go. I'm not saying that, you know, the military budget is perfect or that they allocate the resources correctly, because if they did, we wouldn't be in the trouble that we're in, especially as far as cyber and space are concerned. But it is important to have that military budget. It is important to have these resources allocated to these things. And the Democrats would probably love to create their own surveillance state just so they can monitor who's thinking the right things. You know what I mean? At least the right would try to say we got to weed out the terrorists, but the left would use that technology and say we have to make sure that people aren't hurting other people's feelings and get rid of the racists and the misogynists and everyone has to think like us. The left will use that technology to make sure everyone thinks like them. The right will use the technology to weed out terrorists. So, I mean, if you really think about it, but, you know, the beauty of America is that the people are going to say, get the fuck off my lawn. Okay, get those cameras out of the way. And to be honest, we already have cameras in major cities and major intersections and incompetent police forces that do not use that technology in the way that they should, which is to actually catch criminals, because we, you know, we have plenty of cities like Chicago where murders and the like continuously happen and they are not solving these cases. And you know, I think we're just a little too spoiled in America, period, to like, even if it wasn't a good idea to try to employ the AI that they have in China as far as regulating the body politic and making sure all of these asinine people are not just ruining everything for everyone. We just aren't ready. We don't have the maturity or the consciousness to use that wisely, or for it to actually be effective, because what we're using right now isn't even being used effectively. So why would it make sense for us to even go even farther? But I can see both parties, or any party except for the Libertarian Party, but I think the Libertarian Party is a bunch of naive children that refuse to grow up. But that's another story. Anyway, so moving forward, I'm going to be focusing my research and my writing and my policy analysis and stuff on cyber and space and public health. And I really want to look at the convergence between not just space and cyber, but also space, cyber, and public health. Like, could we use AI or some kind of technology to predict and prevent the next pandemic, right? Like, they're already using artificial intelligence in the Massachusetts General Hospital, I believe, to help with early detection of breast cancer. There is a dream to have, you know, AI in our satellites to help predict where famine will occur in the next 4 to 6 months. If we can actually have that kind of technology to help us predict global social problems, then we can start to cultivate plans to prevent these things from happening. And like I said in another podcast, public health is the bane. It is the foundation of a healthy body politic, of a healthy society. And, one of the main, one of the key factors in measuring good governance is if you have a healthy and vibrant body politic. If you actually have a population that is healthy and able to be productive. Productivity is not limited to automation, which is another problem that we are facing right now with artificial intelligence. It's not that we need to cut back on artificial intelligence, but we need to set up the frameworks to predict these mass job losses. Like COVID-19 has completely eliminated millions of jobs that are not going to come back because either the businesses are closed forever or those positions have been automated because the companies had to find a way to continue to be productive even when they couldn't afford to pay the labor force, right? Or just for safety reasons, they had to figure out another way to be productive while everyone was in quarantine during this pandemic, right? But, you know, when they come up with that innovation and solve that solution, guess what? Tens and thousands of jobs are lost. So how do we solve that, right? And all of that just kind of, you know, it just all comes together. Is there a way to predict the next pandemic and mitigate and or prevent, you know, the damage, the economic damage, the psychological damage, you know what I mean? That is associated with such a tragedy or such a development, you know? And how can space tech, you know, not just help us create prosthetics and artificial hearts and organs, but, you know, how can it help, you know, the healthcare industry create even better technology for quarantine stations? You know, do hospitals need to have quarantine floors and quarantine facilities that can be used at any given time for any given outbreak and then, you know, managed and used for other, other diseases or other treatments in the meantime? And always, or do, should facilities always have a quarantine floor? Because we still have highly contagious, like, so people still get the Black Plague. People still end up with, contagious diseases. It could be a common flu floor, you know? I mean, like, we need to start thinking in different ways, you know? And how do we build these facilities quickly, you know? We don't have a billion people that, you know, may or may not need a job that we can just send anywhere to build these things, you know? Do we leverage 3D printing technology to build these new facilities, you know? Like, how do we solve these problems with these technologies that are helping us go into space, that will help us colonize Mars, that will help take humanity into the future? So, and if anyone reads if you go to my blog, awakendemagogue.com, you will be able to see that I have categories: cosmology and society, statecraft and good governance. So, I'm just gonna really get back into writing or podcasting or both, likely both, and, you know, sharing my thoughts there, you know, and really doing the research. The last couple of days I've been, you know, watching documentaries or reading articles just to get a preliminary understanding of where we are in space, in our second round space race, and what advocacy groups are out there. And it's not a lot, you know, there's not a lot of research or analysis on, you know, space and cyber. I mean, everyone wants to talk about cyber and tech and AI because it's right here on the ground and it makes sense. But when it comes to going into outer space and doing this next level shit that is happening right now, people are just not you know, no one's ready. I don't think people are really ready to live Stargate or Star Wars or Star Trek, no matter how cool it may be, because it's just still so, you know, just it's just too remote from us, right? We lack the imagination in that area. But it's time for us to get on board, and we have to take space and cyber very, very seriously, because cybersecurity, if, like, I'm recording this podcast on my phone right now, you know what I mean? Like, so many people have built their businesses on the internet. Cybersecurity should be a major concern for you, especially if you have an online aspect of your business or just an online business. Guess what? Cybersecurity fucking matters. Okay, it's not just about, like, Target getting hacked or some other startup getting hacked and then emails being leaked everywhere. It's far beyond that. It's far more complex than that. And if China and Russia decide to act on their capabilities to take out our satellites, which, you know, their main asset is to be able to track the launch of a nuclear missile, you know what I mean? Like, that's a major thing, because they can also take out the satellites that help us communicate, like, just, you know, on a daily basis, whether it's on the internet, whether it's GPS to get to where we're going, whether it's the, you know, Google Street View. I use it all the time to try to see where I'm going. And if I have to find a new place, I would like to get a glimpse of what building I should be looking at or looking for. You know what I mean? It will disrupt our communications. You know, it will be to the point of an EMP almost. So these are things that actually matter to us on a daily basis, the regular person. It's not just some esoteric area for white men that, you know, are bored and just sit around and code and figure it out, and Asians, you know what I mean, and the Pakistanis. You know, it's very important. Everybody needs to know about it. Everybody needs to pay attention to it. Everybody needs to have it at least somewhere on their radar. I know we're all kind of in survival mode right now. I am too. Just trying to make sure we can stay alive and pay the bills. But we need to make sure that we have the security apparatus is in place to ensure that we have bills to keep paying, to make sure that we have the freedom to move where we want to move, to keep whatever roof we want over our heads. A problem with Americans is that we're so goddamn spoiled by the results of the sacrifices of, you know, our military or, you know, just our ancestors in the Black community. You know, we think everyone owes us something. But the thing is, MLK and the civil rights leaders and activists, they died so that we can be right here where we are right now. Equality of opportunity, period. We all can get out there and hustle. We might have to hustle a little bit harder, a little bit more than some of our peers, but we all can get out there and hustle and make the money and do what we want to do with ourselves and our lives, period. We can. We really can. And we need to take advantage of that opportunity as a collective. And more of us need to get into STEM or just in policy or in our arts and antiquities anyway. And that's another thing that I'm going to be focusing on in my content is the synthesis, right? Bringing all of these pieces together, whether it's arts and antiquities, anthropology, archaeology, theology, these little things that I've been looking into and taking classes on for years, alongside my formal education in government and international relations and public policy. All of these pieces come together, especially if we're going to be the spacefaring nation that may or may not rediscover or reconnect with or disclose our ongoing relations with extraterrestrial or interdimensional or intraterrestrial beings that have been guiding humanity or seeded humanity here on Earth. So, you know, it's very important to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, how we came to be, what we're supposed to do with our beings, you know, what kind of world we'll live in. There are actual startups in, I believe, Canada that are developing artificial human beings that are supposed to be able to live among us and interact and just be, you know, be one of us walking around, a little android person walking around, blending into the point where we can't even tell that that's not a human being. You know what I mean? This is where we're going. All of these things are happening right here, right now, in this moment. And we need to be aware of it before our cashier is a beautiful robot. Because, you know, guess what? If you need a robot and all you need is one tech that can tweak the robots that are actually working in the Burger King. Well, guess what? That's a whole lot of jobs lost. What are we going to do? You know what I mean? That's just here on the ground. You know, astronauts, human astronauts no longer needed because that startup successfully created android cyborg people who can withstand traveling in outer space and give us the analysis, or even better analysis, than a human astronaut actually traveling. But it's actually safer because we don't have to worry about the physical body, the organic body breaking down in space, because we're not really made for space in that way. That's another possibility. And then, you know, all these sexy astronaut jobs go out the window, or they're just repurposed as some kind of, you know, astronaut tech position that, you know, you just remote control, you know, or just you get the feed, you analyze the feedback from the android that was sent out there to explore space. You know, this is where we're going. And we have to understand that whether it's the private sector, or the public sector, or just governments, period, we are in space. We're launching satellites. We're sending probes to different planets. We got Elon Musk and the crew hell-bent on terraforming and or colonizing Mars. And it's all happening right now. Right here, right now, in this moment. And it's very important because, like I said, Russia and China are on the ball, but they are not our friends. So what does that look like? Right? What does the advancement, you know, of the Space Force or NASA or the private sector's space discoveries and those advancements, what does that look like as far as our cooperation or competition with countries that are now, for all intents and purposes, our adversaries? What does that look like? You know, China's world domination plan might have been thwarted abysmally and horribly. It's an ignominious loss for them, you know, due to COVID. But they're still on point as far as artificial intelligence. They're still on point as far as technology is concerned. Russia is still on point as far as misinformation and disinformation campaigns are concerned. What does that mean for the U.S. going forward? So those are the kind of questions that I'm going to be trying to answer as far, you know, and of course exploring what it really means, you know, the ancient aliens, you know, when we look up these antiquities that ISIS, you know, pillages, plunders, and then resells, and that's a thing. Arts, you know, antiquities are actually a major cash cow for terrorist organizations like ISIS. It's actually one of the ways that they fund their operations. They raid these sacred sites, and they steal these antiquities, and then they sell them on the black market. A lot of them end up in art galleries here and there, wherever, or with traders or dealers. It's a real thing, and it all happens, and it all actually matters, especially if we care about knowing who we are, if we have any kind of spiritual belief or a religious belief. All of this is important because it gives us context on the history of humanity, how we understand ourselves right now, and where we see ourselves going in the future. So check out my blog or subscribe to it, www.awakeneddemagogue.com. We'll have more information and content coming up on these subjects for you guys. You can also follow the Facebook page, facebook.com/awakeneddemagogue7. I'll be sharing tidbits and clips and things there. Of course, subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast, wherever you're listening to this episode right now, or if you just happen to find this on Anchor but you still listen to Spotify. I'm on Spotify, I'm on Google Podcasts, I'm on Apple Podcasts, I'm everywhere. All right, so that's, I guess, my grand intro or something to my new little pivot. But I'll chat soon with you guys later. Deuce.